Listen up, listen up. Jim's in the hospital. He called me Friday night, I guess, and he had been at a wedding rehearsal and got to feeling some chest pain and lightheaded. Thought he was having a heart attack. Went to the emergency room. I'm sorry. That's Friday night. So they put him in the hospital. They said he had not had a heart attack, but his heart was running away. His heart rate was 170. He's got AFib, yes. And so they tried to get that settled down with some medication and then kept him overnight Saturday and then overnight last night to make sure everything was okay. He's been evaluated. I think he's gonna probably get an ablation for an abnormal pacemaker in his heart. I'm talking about the normal electrical pacemaker in the heart. He's got a pacemaker in, an artificial one, but it's only kicks in if the heart rate goes down, not if the heart rate goes up. So he'll have an ablation probably in the next few weeks to try and control this rapid heart rate. And, you know, that should solve the problem. But that's probably been a big part of all of his condition all along over the last couple of months.
What's an ablation?
Ablation, I'm talking out of my field now, but basically the heart has a pacemaker in it. It's the electrical system of the heart. And there's a normal nodal pacemaker which controls your heart rate, and that's why your heart, you know, beat 72 to 80 times a minute. You exercise hard, it might go up to 120, maybe 130, but rarely ever goes over that. And he has atrial fib, which means that sometimes the heart rate goes much higher because of the atrial fib. It's an abnormal pacemaker. And so what they do is they go in and they destroy that with an electrical current. And if it works, then that's fine. If it doesn't work, then they have to do additional procedure where he's then permanently on a pacemaker, which controls his heart, different than the kind he's got in now. So once your heart rate goes over about 130 or 140, it's very inefficient because it doesn't allow enough time for the heart to fill up with blood to pump it out. So, you know, his blood pressure was extremely low and he was confused and, you know, because he just wasn't getting enough blood to his brain. And so that's the danger of atrial fib and an abnormal pacemaker. So that's where Jim is today. I think he's hoping to come home, and unless something happened last night, which I don't know about, he'll be home. So we're very pleased to have a guest teacher with us this morning by the name of Charles Herbst. So Charles is going to fill in for Jim, I'm sure inadequately, but he'll do the best he can on short notice. And so what I did, I asked him to pull some slides together on a topic that I think is of great interest to us. The topic of euthanasia is hot in the news. California just passed a law last year, which went into effect in June of this year. And I saw where the first person had that just a few weeks ago. And there's a bill in our state legislature to make euthanasia or physician-assisted suicide a right or a choice here in this state. So you'll be hearing a lot about this in the next year, and so I think it's a great topic to talk about today and get your feedback and hopefully maybe even educate you a little bit about it from a physician's viewpoint. So that's the reason why I asked Charles to present this morning. So Charles, I'll turn it over to you. Well, thank you so much for that. So, we're going to talk about euthanasia. Let's start with prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, again, we thank you, as we always do, for this day where we can come and worship you, where we can study your word. Hopefully, we study your word every day of the week, but especially so on Sunday, because it is your day. And so that's what we're here for, is to study your word, learn about you, and learn about issues that are pertinent and that apply to us in our culture. So we just ask for guidance as we study the topic of euthanasia this morning. We ask that you continue to be with Jim as he recovers, and we pray that he is able to go home today, and that he'll soon have a surgery that will rid him of this problem that has plagued him so much for the last couple of months. So just be with him and Cece as they go through this trial together. In your name we pray. Amen. Well, we're talking about euthanasia today, and it raises the question, it raises the question of what is euthanasia. It's a very complicated issue, and I tried to put on this slide some of the issues that we talk about. We talk about quality of life. What is the effect of depression? Somebody has a terminal illness. How does depression affect their desire maybe to have euthanasia? We talk about DNR, do not resuscitate. We talk about natural death. Of course, there's financial resources that are a big issue right now with universal health care, insurance companies are trying to cut out benefits in order to make money, and so on and so forth. So it's a very complicated issue, and we'll try and work our way through this landmine this morning. We're not going to answer all the questions, but hopefully we'll begin to answer a few. So the question is, what is euthanasia? What does it mean? What's your idea of euthanasia? What do you think euthanasia means? When you hear that word, we hear it tossed around a lot.
Good death.
Well, that's the Greek meaning of the word, is good death. So define good death. How would you like to die? We all die.
Quick.
It's great for the person that's dying, but it's not so great for the family because they're unprepared, ill-prepared for it. It's an interesting question. You talk to patients, and you learn as a doctor after a while, most people would rather die over several months, not a quick death. And the reason is because it allows them to prepare. You don't know how many times I've had a patient say, well, you know, I got to set my business in order. I've got to write my will. They don't even have a will. Or I need to sell some property that's going to be a big problem for my wife to take care of, or something like that. I never will forget a Jewish man that I had, and he had terminal cancer, and he was going to be dying, and he ended up coming into the hospital, and the wife said, you know, how long is he going to be around? And I said, I don't know. But I said, you need to get the family here. Well, my daughter is taking finals this week in college, and my son is overseas, and I forget all the problems. I said, you still need to get them here. And so they did, and he died a few days later. And she was very, very thankful that they had had the opportunity to spend a couple of days with their dad before he died. So it's just an interesting phenomena. Most people are ill-prepared for death. They have things they'd want to do, some unfinished business. I know I've got a will, I've got a health care, power of attorney, I've got all that, but I haven't looked at it in the last 6 or 8 years, and this lesson prompted me to think, I got to review that and get a lawyer to look at it, make sure it's up to snuff, because the laws have changed and no telling what kind of situation we're in now.
Charles.
Yes.
I remember reading from one of Catherine Marshall's books, talk about good death, where she described the death of her father, who was a pastor. He was in his late 60s, rocking on his front porch with several of his good friends, with less than $10 in the bank, and he rocked, breathed heavily, and passed away. That's a good death.
Yeah, well, that's a good death. It's a good death if you can spend it with your family.
Right.
Don't you think?
And close friends.
And close friends, yeah. Right, right. And a big part of dying is loneliness. You'd be surprised how many patients I've had where, you know, the family is very distant. You know, and they're there by themselves. They don't have a family. They maybe got a pastor, and he's their family or a church. So it's a big issue. All right, so it comes from the Greek word meaning a good death. Yes?
I just wanted to say one thing. We had a family friend growing up, and it always stuck with me that whenever he prayed in public or grace around a meal or something, he always ended his prayer saying, "Lord, give me a peaceful moment in which to die."
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That was a good prayer.
And we'll get to this a little bit later. We're getting ahead. But for the Christian, that's entirely different from the non-Christian, a peaceful moment, because we've got Christ. All right. So we've talked about that, a good death. Today's definition of euthanasia is different from the way it used to be. Good death was basically started when Socrates took the hemlock. You know, that was a good death. He died peacefully. That was a suicide. It was not assisted suicide like we're going to be talking about today. That was a suicide. And it's the concept of euthanasia has waxed and waned over the centuries. Of course, when Christianity came in, because of the sanctity of life, because we're made in God's image, it became a Christian thought was against euthanasia, because euthanasia back in those days was a good death, sometimes assisted, sometimes not assisted, depending upon how you looked at it. So today's definition of euthanasia is basically the intentional act or practice of killing another person for his or her alleged benefit. And you notice I've underlined intentional and I've underlined alleged, because those are the details that get us into some of the heated discussion about it. I think it's pretty clear what intentional is. You do something with intent. But what does alleged mean? Is it alleged in the eyes of the patient or in the eyes of the person that's helping him? And what do we mean by that? So euthanasia basically now means someone who wants to commit suicide and ask for help in doing that. All of these laws that have been passed in Oregon, Washington, California, Netherlands, Belgium, Luxembourg, some of these other places, they don't have anything to do with suicide. It's nothing against suicide. A person can still commit suicide. They can kill themselves. But it's the assisted part of it that comes into play. They want help to commit suicide. And so that makes, instead of it being one party, it makes it two parties participating in this practice. So today's definition is intentional and alleged. I want to go over a few definitions so that we kind of are all on the same page by what we mean. Suicide is voluntary and self-administered. I think that's pretty clear. Voluntary euthanasia means that the patient requests help to commit suicide. They're still mentally alert, they know what they're doing, and they request help in committing suicide. That's voluntary. Involuntary, the patient, if they were able, could ask for help, but they're not able. They're in a coma. but maybe they had a living will, or they gave instructions to their spouse about what they would like if they were ever ended up in a coma. So that's involuntary euthanasia. And then there's non-voluntary. That's the patient who doesn't have the mental capacity and is unable to ask or request. That would be the mentally challenged person or somebody that's disabled and unable to understand what euthanasia is or participate in the decision.
Charles,
so, yes.
Could you define what you mean by a living will?
I'll get to that.
Okay.
That's next week. All right, some confusing terms. Active euthanasia is usually an act of commission. In other words, you commit something, you do something to help that person. As a doctor, you prescribe a drug that they take to commit suicide. That's what physician-assisted suicide is in all states where it's been passed so far. It's not the Kevorkian stuff where you hook them up to an IV and you allow them to push a button which then injects something. That's different. All of the laws are written so that it's medication that you're giving the patient, and they either take it in front of the doctor, as some laws require, but most laws require that they get, or allow them to take it home and take it then at their pleasure. But you're supposed to be a medical person usually present, which we'll get into. That doesn't always occur. So active euthanasia is usually interpreted as an act that a commission. Passive euthanasia implies omission. And oftentimes that is described as natural death. In other words, you don't do anything to hasten the death, but you don't do anything to prevent it either. It's the terminal patient that you know is going to die within the next week, and they've got pneumonia, and you decide, along with their request, not to give them antibiotics for their pneumonia because they just don't want to suffer anymore. So natural death is probably a much better term, because to say active or passive euthanasia, you're still using the term euthanasia, and by definition today, that means assisted suicide. So it's better to avoid the term passive euthanasia, at least in my opinion. Right to die. This is a constitutional right. It was decided by the Supreme Court back in 1972, I think, with the, not the Cruzan, Quinlan case. We'll talk about that if we have time. But everybody has a constitutional right to decline treatment or to determine the how they will die. Terminal is usually means that the doctor anticipates the patient will die from their disease within 6 months. But we know we're all human and we make mistakes, and our estimates are wrong. And for that reason, most doctors won't say that. They'll say, well, you know, I think you'll live anywhere from a few weeks to a few months to maybe even a few years. So they don't like to get pinned down into time, because it's been shown with hospice data that about 10% of patients admitted to hospice, which is one of the criteria for being admitted to hospice, they live longer than 6 months. And so it's a guessing game sometimes. Mercy killing. This is really an act of compassion. We'll talk about mercy killing, but physician-assisted suicide is oftentimes defined as mercy killing. It's an act of compassion. The patient's in excruciating pain or something like that, and so a person helps them commit suicide out of compassion to put them out of their suffering. Physician-assisted suicide is usually prescribed drugs, as I said before. And then there's some euphemisms. Assisted dying is one you'll hear. Death with Dignity. Did anybody attend the symposium they had over at the Friday Center a few months ago? I think the Council on Aging for Orange County put it on it. I was very surprised. Rosemary and I went, and there was probably, what would you say, Rosemary, maybe 400 or 500 people there? I'd say 400 or 500 people. They had a panel discussion, had several doctors, had a lawyer, had some ethicists there, had a woman that was a advocate for euthanasia or a physician-assisted suicide, and she gave her testimony. But there was a lot of interest, and it was very interesting to me. It seemed like the crowd leaned more toward physician-assisted suicide than against it. Would you say that, Rosemary? Yeah, I would say that. So I was very surprised, and I was very disappointed at that. So there are a lot of euphemisms that we use with it to make it sound good or acceptable. I'm going to go into the biblical arguments against euthanasia just to kind of get that out of the way. All of us are Christians, so I think that we would agree with this. These are moral arguments. They're different from ethical arguments. What's the difference between a moral principle and an ethical principle? That requires some thought. I hadn't thought about this either. Sometimes what's morally wrong is ethically okay. Morality is internal. Ethical is external. Doctors have an ethical code they practice by. Lawyers practice by ethical code that they have developed. So it's usually determined by the culture they're in, the society, the prevalent views at that time. A moral code is something that's internal. It's something that you learn from your religion. So if you're a Christian, you have certain principles that become incorporated into your conscience. It's your conscience that tells you what's right or wrong based upon your religious beliefs or what your mom and dad taught you, or even your culture sometimes can have effects on it. So the Christian arguments against euthanasia are moral arguments. It's something that's fine for us, but it's not what you want to use when you're trying to discuss this with a non-Christian. Because the first thing they do is throw it out. I don't believe in the Bible, and I don't believe in Christ. And so what other kind of arguments have you got? So then you have to go to ethical arguments. So let's get the moral arguments out of the way. Yes?
To me, suicide has an ugly connotation. And to die in Christ Jesus when you're old and hurting is a lovely thing. Death can be a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
But the word suicide just sounds like you've done something terrible.
Yeah. Well, it is, but I never will forget, I had a lady, I was up here at the church one day doing something, and she came in and needed some counseling. I was the only person around, so, and I was an elder at the time, so somebody asked me if I'd go talk to her. And she was afraid, she had thoughts of suicide, she was depressed. And she had thoughts of suicide. And she said, well, I go to hell if I commit suicide. Well, I had to be honest with her and tell her, no, you're a Christian. Your standing with Christ is firm. It's not going to change. Is suicide a sin? Yes, I think the Bible teaches that it's a sin. It's not something that you should do. But are you going to hell because you commit suicide? No. So we had a long discussion about that. I think she's still around. So I think that, I was apprehensive after all that conversation. Did I, help her make a decision to commit suicide? I don't think I did. It was a judgment call. Unfortunately, I guess I made the right call. But yeah, it's a sin, but it doesn't make us go to hell because we do it. At least that's my interpretation. I'm happy to hear anybody else's thoughts about that. All right, so let's get into the big biblical arguments or we'll never get through. We are created in the image of God. Then the Lord said, let us make man in our image. So that's one moral argument against it. So we need to respect the fact that we're in the image of God, and we're forbidden to murder. Thou shalt not murder. It's one of the Ten Commandments. God is sovereign over life and death. The Lord gave and the Lord taketh away, Deuteronomy. Death is both unnatural and inevitable. You have to think about that for a minute. When we ate the fruit in the garden, when Eve and Adam ate the fruit in the garden, death became unnatural and also became inevitable because of our sin. Continuing on, death is a spiritual event with biological consequences. Dust returns to the ground it came from, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. So the body and the spirit are different. When we die, we get a new body. Suffering may have a value toward God, and it may have value toward others. And we've touched on this, death is not the end for the Christian. It's just a door, and it's basically the beginning, if you think about it. So what are the secular arguments or the ethical arguments for euthanasia, and then we'll talk about those against it. There are two, autonomy and compassion. Autonomy means doing something that I think should be done to me. So I think it and I do it. That's autonomy. Compassion is doing what someone else thinks should be done to me. And if you think about it, although they're both used as rationale to support euthanasia, they're contradictory. If you're completely autonomous, then you make the decision and you do it. But once you ask somebody to help you do it, you lose some of your autonomy. Not all of it, but some of it, at least if it's voluntary. If it's involuntary euthanasia, and this is one of the problems with euthanasia, is a slippery slope. We found from the data in the Netherlands and Belgium that what was supposed to be voluntary euthanasia, now many of those people are being killed involuntarily over there. The doctor's making the decision without even telling the patient and euthanizing them. And this then raises the question, well, what about those who are unable to make a decision at all? The mentally retarded. You know, in Belgium, they just passed a law that allows doctors to now kill children. Yeah. So if they've got a child that's mentally retarded or has a disability and the doctor thinks that, you know, he's unhappy and can't live a full and fruitful life, he can now, this is Belgium, just got passed about a year, within the last year. And of course, you don't know how much of that is being done now that's just not reported.
Charles, is that just within the U.S.?
No, that's Belgium. Belgium. It's not in the, to my knowledge, it's not in the U.S. But this is part of the argument against it, we'll get to in a minute, is that it's a slippery slope. Where do you end up? If you go back to history, we had in the 30s in the United States, we passed a progeny law that allowed us to sterilize people that we thought were mentally shouldn't be having children, couldn't take care of them, or maybe their children might turn out to be mentally impaired. And you know, this state participated in that, and there's been a big lawsuit and a restitution back in the last couple of 3 years because of what we did back in the 30s. For that. Of course, it got a bad name with World War II and the Nazis, because they carried it to the ultimate goal of you know, prison camps and concentration camps and gassing millions of people. But, all right. So autonomy, the two justifications for autonomy is to preserve dignity and to avoid being a burden. And avoid being a burden, of course, opens up a whole Pandora's box of did they do it voluntarily or were they coerced into making that decision because they wanted to save some resources for the family or because the family member was inconvenienced and couldn't take care of mom anymore, you know. And then compassion, the main thing there is to avoid pain. Or you can add other things. They can't sleep well, or they're depressed, or they can't eat well, or they can't control their bowels. You know, they've got a colostomy, and they don't like having a bag and smell. That's part of my practice, was that. Ethical arguments against euthanasia. Natural death is not murder, but assisted suicide is. You're asking somebody to participate in your murder. Suicide is murdering yourself. Assisted suicide is asking someone to participate with you in murdering yourself. Euthanasia is often a cry for help. They can't sleep and they need something to help them sleep, or they're in pain and pain is not being adequately managed. Or they're lonely. Their families abandon them. They have no support. It's a cry for help oftentimes. It undermines the patient-physician relationship. And this is very important because this plays into the right of conscience that you hear so much about now, especially with pharmacists and the abortion issue and the day after pill. But the same thing applies to doctors. And especially so now that you no longer have a personal physician. You got a team taking care of you. When Jim went into the hospital the other day, he had a team taking care of him. His cardiologist probably wasn't even involved. He was under the care of a hospitalist or an intensivist if he was in the intensive care unit. And then there were residents involved. Well, so somebody on the team decides the patient needs to be euthanized, but somebody else on the team doesn't feel it. How does that play? And where is the trust anymore? In the Netherlands, there are actually people, the pro-life group has put out cards that people can put in their billfold that say, I do not want to be euthanized, because they're so afraid of being involuntarily euthanized. And they've even got lists that you can access on the internet that tells you what hospitals do not euthanize patients over there. So that if you get sick, you want to go to that hospital, because you don't want to go to this one over here. They might euthanize you. It's very interesting. It's very interesting when you ask patients who have who are in good health, elderly patients in good health, do they support euthanasia? And most of them will say yes. You ask the same group of patients but with a terminal illness, very few of them say yes. Isn't that interesting? So as long as you're healthy, oh yeah, that's okay, yeah, I'm all for that. But when it affects you, it's a little bit different story.
Charles.
Yes.
Lisa.
Yeah.
Lisa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey. Help me, I don't see well, Lisa, so you gotta y'all holler at me.
Voluntary euthanasia means that someone has already given instructions to be...
No.
No, it doesn't.
It means that someone else makes the decision for you.
Oh.
In other words, you're in the hospital and you're unconscious. and there's nobody there, and you don't have a living will or anything like that, they'll say, well, you know, the likelihood of her getting better is slim, and I really don't think that she would want me to do this. So she would want to live like this. So I'll euthanize her. So it's involuntary.
So what's the difference between involuntary and non-voluntary?
Non-voluntary is they're not capable of making a decision anyhow. So that would be the severely disabled person, probably mentally disabled, so they don't understand what euthanasia is. Mm-hmm. And of course, that's part of the problem with this law that just got passed in Belgium. Because now the parents can say, well, you know, we don't want this child anymore because it's disabled. So they're euthanizing. Wow. All right, so let's see, where are we? It undermines the patient-physician relationship. There's a lack of trust now. If you think about it, when you go to the doctor, you're expecting him to help you get better, to restore your health, not to take it away from you. It ignores the right of religious conscience. And we touched on that, so I won't go into that anymore. And euthanasia is a slippery slope, and I've mentioned that before. Because in the Netherlands and the Belgium, it started out, it was voluntary. Now, almost half of the deaths in the Netherlands and Belgium are involuntary. And those are only the ones that are reported. It's estimated that half, based upon death certificates and so forth, half of the patients euthanized are never reported. And the same thing applies to Oregon, which has got the longest standing records here in the United States. You're supposed to fill out all this stuff, but if you don't fill it out, who's to know? So it's a slippery slope. And then compassionate care, if compassionate care, in my opinion, trumps the need for physician-assisted suicide. If you receive compassionate care from your doctor and he controls your pain and he sticks by you through this time, and you're not a burden to him, you don't need physician-assisted suicide. He'll help you die. All right, Oregon criteria. I put this in because I just thought it'd be helpful to know what the criteria are. We don't know if all this is being followed or not. The patient must be a resident of Oregon. Oregon is the oldest one. It got passed in... I think it was 1994 that they had their first statewide vote on it, and I think it was 51% to 49% that were in favor of euthanasia. And then they passed a law in, I think it was 94, but then this was challenged in court, so they really didn't get started well until years later. I guess it was close to the year 2000 or so. Oregon was the first state in the nation to have a euthanasia. It was followed by Washington State in 2002, then Vermont a few years later, and then most recently, California. There's only four states in the United States that have it legalized by state law. There's two other states which allow it, but it's been by court injunction. One is Montana, and the other one is New Mexico, but that's by court action, not by a law passed by the legislature. All right, so remember there was a lady that had a brain cancer not long ago. I can't remember her name. Does anybody remember her name? Moved from California to Oregon so she could become a resident and be euthanized. I forget her name. But that happened before the law was, and that was the big impetus to get the law passed in California. The pro-assisted suicide group really pushed that and got it passed because of that. So that is held up. They all are residents of the state of Oregon. The patient must make a written request to a licensed physician. And as far as we know, that's being done, but there's no way to document that. So that's an assumption. The physician must certify that the illness is terminal, that is, that the patient is expected to die within 6 months. And again, that's an assumption, but we don't have any way to follow that. The physicians must inform the patient of the diagnosis and alternate treatments. And again, we don't know. It's assumed that that's being done, but you don't know whether that's being done or not. Another physician must be consulted to confirm the diagnosis. Again, it's an assumption. There's no way to know. The records are very poor. And again, like I said, based upon data from death certificates, the assumption is made that about half of the patients euthanized in Oregon are not ever even reported. So the data that you see on the internet is based upon reported data. And so it could be much different if you really had all of the data.
The question yes. that I have is, are they in Oregon diagnosing that terminal diagnosis earlier than they would in a place like North Carolina? Because most hospice stays are like less than 10 days when that's the terminal date. So to hear that it feels like they're maybe diagnosing it really early, which would be a real different mindset than some other states.
I can't answer that question. Most patients in Oregon die under hospice care. And most patients are either Medicare or Medicaid patients. And almost all of them have insurance, either Medicare, Medicaid, or private insurance. Most of them are more educated. The less educated people use euthanasia less frequently than the more educated. And there are some others, but I can't recall them right off the top of my head.
Charles?
Yes?
Can these patients be organ donors?
I'm sorry, can they be an organ donor? I would say practically no, because most of them are given the medication, and although they're supposed to be a physician or a healthcare person there, most patients take them at home. Or take them, they're under hospice care. You know, home hospice care or in a hospice unit. So I would say no, but I don't have any data to support that. All right, there must be at least 48 hours of waiting period. No earthly idea, we don't know. And the act also states that insurance should not impact it. And again, most of them have insurance, so. We don't know whether part of it is because they couldn't get that chemotherapy treatment because the insurance company wouldn't pay for it or what. We just don't know. Was there a question?
No, just a sneeze.
Okay. All right. This is some of the data from the state of Oregon. You see that a whole lot more medication is given out than is used. Which really, to me, makes me think, well, how many of these people are depressed? And, after a few days, they get better. And they decide, well, I don't think I'll take that medicine after all. Isn't that interesting? It's interesting that in Oregon, they're supposed to go see a psychiatrist just for that fact. 5% do. 5%. I don't know. There's no teeth in the law. In other words, there's no punishment. If you don't do it, the doctor is not punished for it. So, there's no incentive to do it. You're not going to be punished for it, If I tell my grandchild not to run out in the street, he's going to get a whipping, and he runs out in the street, and I say, well, that's okay, just don't do it again. What's he going to do? He's going to keep running out in the street until he gets punished.
In terms of this slide, what does prescription recipients mean?
That's the people that received a prescription with the intent of taking it to commit suicide.
So the difference is those that didn't use it.
Yeah.
Okay.
So the two lines, the dark blue line is those that took it. The light blue line is that how many patients got the prescription. But then you see there's a big chunk of them that didn't ever use it.
Okay.
And that does not include persons where the doctor prescribes, say, maybe some pain medicine for control of pain, and so the patient just takes an overdose. There's no intent with that. The doctor was intending it to control the pain. The patient abused that intent and usurped it to commit suicide. That's not part of this. That's accidental.
Charles.
All right.
Charles.
It's time for questions and comments. Yes.
Are the physicians required to participate in this?
No, they're not required, but that's of concern. And again, it boils down to the team approach of medical care today. So, you know, if I've got a team of doctors with me taking care of a patient, and I say, you know, I do not believe in euthanasia. I'm going to support this patient. I'm going to manage their pain. I'm going to make sure that they realize they're not a burden to me, and I'm going to take care of them to the end. And I'm off that weekend, and somebody under me then decides to euthanize that patient. So is that an impingement upon my right of conscience? Is that forcing something on me that I didn't intend? Yeah. It's just like the abortion issue. You know, you have to teach a OBGYN resident now in most places has to be taught how to do an abortion, even though they don't support it. They have to do them as part of their training. Yeah.
Any data concerning the tremendous advances in technology to keep people alive and how much longer we're living that could play a
well, that's I mean, that's the big impetus behind all of this. It's really interesting. You remember the what's it called? The Dunker tank, the old iron lung. For polio, you remember that? Some of y'all would remember that. I might have seen one in my whole lifetime. But that was designed to try, when you get polio, sometimes you recover from it. Not completely, but you recover enough. Part of the problem with it was that it affected respiration in some of these people. And so they would put them in the iron lung to get them over the acute illness with the hopes that they would then be restored back to health. Well, the problem was some didn't get better. So now what do? This person is on the iron lung for the rest of their life, maybe, you know, for the next 30 years or so. And so that kind of stimulated the movement toward euthanasia back in the 30s. And of course, that got sidetracked because of World War II and what happened to Nazi Germany. And so it didn't become a real issue again until the Quinlan case in 72, I think it was. And this was a girl that you'll recall, she took an overdose and ended up in a vegetative state, and she was on a respirator. And so after a couple of years, the family wanted to remove her from the respirator, and the hospital wouldn't allow her. I mean, they were concerned with a lawsuit or something, I guess. So it went to the Supreme Court, and finally the Supreme Court ruled that it was her constitutional right to be taken off of the respirator if she wished. But since she didn't have a living will, which didn't exist at that time, or had never expressed her wishes, and her parents were the next of kin and responsible for her care, and the parents wanted her taken off the respirator, that the parents could do this. So the parents took her off the respirator. She lived another 10 years or so and finally died of her disease. But that was the beginning of the living will, the healthcare power of attorney, the DNR. All of those things came out of that lawsuit back in 1972, and that's what got the, you know, the physician-assisted suicide movement going again.
Charlie, is there any information on very liberal hospice versus very conservative hospice? In other words, there's some hospices that commit euthanasia with their morphine.
I don't know. I'm not aware of any data. It might be, but I'm not aware of it.
Charles,
yeah.
As a physician, how do you deal with the do not resuscitate order when you might, as a physician, have the knowledge that that person essentially could be resuscitated? How do you deal with that?
Well, the order is written before, you know, the arrest occurs. So you've already had that discussion with the family. You know, your dad is 82, he's got bad lung disease, his heart's not working well, he's mentally impaired, he's got, you know, Alzheimer's or something. What do you want done? Well, and they'll usually say, well, we've had discussions about this with dad, and dad said he just doesn't want to live like that anymore. So you make an agreement to do a DNR. And so then, you know, unfortunately he has an arrest, then you don't resuscitate him. You're abiding by the family's wishes as expressed to him. Now today, we had the option of writing all that down and getting a legal document out of it. Or assigning somebody with a health care power of attorney, not a financial power of attorney. Those need to be different because you can have a conflict of interest there. If your son is managing your estate and he's also managing your health care, he might do you in order to get that money. I mean, you know, that's the rationale behind it. So when you write a health care power of attorney, it needs to be a different person.
But how is that different than assisted suicide, someone who comes to you and says, I want to die?
They won't help to commit suicide. One is taking life, doing something to shorten life. The other is allowing a natural process to occur because there's no hope. Person's got a terminal cancer and they're in bad pain and they don't want to live any longer like that. And so you support them in the dying process. You don't prolong death, but you don't hasten it either. Right.
There is a very fine line.
It's a very fine line.
It's very difficult.
Yeah. And that's the reason why the slippery slope, I think, is a very valid argument. Because we've got proof that that occurs now. We know that in the Netherlands and Belgium, and even in probably in Oregon, we just can't document it. There are a lot of people that are getting euthanized involuntarily that don't have any say-so at all about it. And this is a real threat to those who are disabled. It's kind of an interesting, I guess you'd call it a paradox, or maybe even a dichotomy in our society today. We have a lot of people that push toward abolishing capital punishment. It's not right to kill somebody because they're a criminal and they're a serial killer or a terrorist or whatever. But yet we want to commit suicide and we won't help in committing it. Those don't jive to me. they just don't make sense. Okay. All right. Any announcements? Oh, have we got any guests we need to recognize? Any guests? Stand up and let us recognize you. Tell us who you are. Where are you from?
I'm Jerry Zuck. I'm from Demopolis, Alabama. I'm moving up here to Burlington, North Carolina. I hope it was a son.
Oh, okay. Well, we have a tradition that you tell us where you went to the first grade, if you can remember.
First grade?
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. It was in Alabama.
No, Richmond, Virginia.
Richmond, Virginia. Oh, oh, Richmond, Virginia.
Even more since.
So you went further south then?
Yeah. I went all the way to Florida.
Oh, well, that's a Yankee outpost in Dixieland. That doesn't count. All right, any other guests? Anybody over here? All right, let's keep Jim in our prayers, and hopefully he'll be back next week. Class dismissed.
Thank you.